In general, HRT is beneficial for most women. And while you need to start it as close to menopause as possible, there's huge benefit in terms of cardiovascular disease risk, in terms of osteoporosis, right? 80% of the people on the planet who have osteoporosis are women. And that's because estrogen and progesterone signaling to your bone is really important for maintaining bone density. So there's a lot of good reasons to take it. And I think I'm very hopeful that we have a lot of entrepreneurs and a lot of companies that are interested in this. And there's a huge, I think there's a huge opportunity to make HRT better than it is right now.
Hi everyone, I am so excited that I have another episode of the Live Longer World podcast. But before we move on to that, I have a quick announcement. I think a lot of you don't know that I also have a newsletter. This is where I share health and longevity tips, including my own health protocol, so you can see what I'm following. I've also started a series called Live Longer Weekly, where I curate longevity tips from people like Rhonda Patrick and Peter Thiel, such that you and I can improve our health week by week. These tips have helped me a lot, and I know that they're helping other readers too. So if you want to stay tuned, go ahead and subscribe at livelongerworld.com. All right, now let's move into today's episode. My guest today is Dr. Jennifer Garrison, who is an assistant professor at the Buck Institute for Research on Aging, where she runs her own lab. Her research focuses on the female reproductive aging system, with an emphasis on the role of the brain in female reproductive aging. In today's conversation, we discussed menopause and its effect on women's health, hormone replacement therapy, and how increasing the number of quality eggs a woman has at age 40 by just 1% can be a game changer. Female reproductive aging is grossly understudied, despite its importance, and Jennifer is one of the pioneers in the field. I hope you enjoy today's conversation. Dr. Garrison, welcome to the Live Longer World podcast.
Hi, thank you.
It's a shame that despite being a woman, I barely know much about reproductive health and women's fertility. So when I was doing research on this topic, I definitely learned a lot and very, very interested to dive deep into this conversation. To start off with some background, why should we care about ovarian aging?
You mean as women? Well, if you happen to own an ovary or two, they're really, I think about them like the pacemakers for aging in the female body. So everyone is familiar with what happens with respect to fertility and ovarian aging. Obviously, with age, the number and the quality of eggs that you have goes down. And that can lead to things like birth defects and infertility and miscarriages. But ovaries are also endocrine organs, which means that they're secreting hormones, which are really just chemical signals that travel between organs to carry messages about all sorts of things. But your ovaries are secreting hormones that are really important for maintaining your overall health. So, for example, they signal to bone to maintain your bone health. They signal to your heart to maintain your health, heart health, and lots of other things. And so, as your ovaries age, that endocrine function gets disrupted, and that can lead to all sorts of increased health risks. And the difference, I think, the reason that it's so important for us to pay attention to is that ovaries are aging prematurely, meaning that they're aging at an accelerated rate compared to the rest of the tissues in your body. And so, thinking about your ovarian function with respect to your overall health is something that becomes important when you're in your 30s and 40s, as opposed to much later in life, which is what happens with men.
Very interesting. Why do you think ovaries are aging so prematurely?
Well, if I had an answer to that question, then we wouldn't be having this conversation. We don't know. That's the really frustrating part, is that we don't know why they age prematurely. We don't know what the causal driving factors are behind that premature aging. And if we did, then we could potentially think about ways to intervene. And by that, I just mean syncing up aging in ovaries with aging in the rest of the body so that we don't have this dramatic, precipitous decline in both fertility and also general health in the middle of our lives.
So is ovarian aging, the progression, is it such that in the beginning years, there's not so much, and then suddenly at the age of 30 or 40 or maybe even late 20s, there's much more accelerated? How would you describe the progression of aging in ovaries?
Well, if we're talking about function, which is really how I categorize organ aging, it's a decline in the number of follicles or eggs that you have in your ovaries, and it's also a decline in the quality that happens over time. And since we don't understand why that happens, the reproductive strategy that humans have evolved to use is very strange. We make all of our eggs up front in one go, in utero, actually. So during gestation, all of the eggs that I was ever going to have were made. And then that number, whatever we start with, by the time we get to be about 40, we're left with somewhere between 2 and 3% of the number that we started with. And so why that happens, why the numbers decline so precipitously at different points along development, I think we just don't know. We haven't done the research to figure that out. But that's why I'm working where I'm working.
Wow. So is the rate of decline the same every decade? Or would you say that, yes, after 30, instead of the rate of decline being 10%, it's 20%?
It's a complicated graph, but on average, and this is on average, female fetuses have about 6 or 7 million eggs in that one go of making them. And then by the time a female is born, that number will have declined to about 1 million. So there's a precipitous drop there. And then wow. By the time she goes through puberty, that number will go down to somewhere on average between 300, 350,000, something like that. And then once you start cycling, you lose around, and again, these are all average numbers, you lose around 1,000 eggs per month. So every time you go through a cycle. And that continues until you're in your 40s or early 50s and you go through menopause and really the cessation of cycling.
1,000 eggs every cycle. Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah, most women don't realize that. So you ovulate, well, usually you ovulate one, sometimes a few more than that accidentally, but typically you ovulate one egg, but there are many, many that are recruited to start growing. And one ends up winning that race and the others are lost through atresia. So I think a lot of women think that if they're taking hormonal birth control and they're suppressing ovulation, that somehow is maintaining their ovarian reserve. But that's actually not true. Just because you stop the ovulation of one egg, it doesn't change the fact that you're still losing those other 999 on average every cycle.
Wow, I see. So you mentioned menopause, which is the cessation of the cycle and when we reach zero eggs, correct? For women?
It's when you pretty much approach zero. It's actually defined as a single day. So menopause, what we're really talking about when we talk about menopause is either perimenopause, which is the period of time before menopause, or postmenopause, which is a period of time after. Menopause is a single day in a woman's life, and it's defined as the day on which she has not had a period for 12 months.
Okay. So I know you've mentioned in the past how it has a cascade of negative effects on a woman's body. I mean, forget the fact that obviously you can't reproduce at that point, but beyond that, there are lots of negative effects. Can you speak to some of these negative consequences?
Yeah, and I want to be clear, we're not thinking about menopause like it's a disease or something like that, but it is really important to consider the endocrine function of ovaries with respect to health. So when a woman's ovaries stop working around menopause, that increases risk of cardiovascular disease fourfold. It increases risk of stroke, of osteoporosis, of autoimmune disease. There's a lot of things that before menopause, you have a certain risk factor to develop them, which is a huge, you know, it's hugely individual, and it depends on your environment, on your genetic background, on your family history, lots of different things. But after menopause, those risks go up dramatically, almost overnight.
Wow. Okay. So what's some of the work you're doing in your lab to dampen some of these negative consequences post-menopause?
I am a research scientist. I have a laboratory at the Buck Institute, which is an independent research institute that's devoted to studying the mechanisms of aging. And, you know, the motivation for that is that if we can slow down or change the rate of aging, right? We can't do anything about chronological age, but we can potentially intervene in terms of the rate of age. The idea is that most chronic diseases of the modern world, at least things like cancer and neurodegenerative disease, those diseases, their number one risk factor is age, your age, more than anything else. So the idea is that if we can exploit the knowledge around how aging works, then we could intervene simultaneously in all of those age-related diseases and have an impact there. So my research lab is focused on trying to understand mind-body communication. So I'm a neuroscientist by training, and I'm very interested in how our brains really drive both physiology and behavior. And with respect to aging, there are neurons, circuits in a part of the brain called the hypothalamus that control things related to homeostasis. So that's really just your body's ability to maintain things around particular set points. So energy, fluid balance, circadian rhythms, reproductive function, and body temperature are all regulated by this particular brain region. And what's cool about these neurons is that they're really diverse, and they're really neurochemically rich, and they use a lot of these, what I call wireless signaling methods. So chemicals that travel between the brain and the rest of the body and in both directions. So I kind of call it the brain's Wi-Fi. But there's like a chemical symphony happening in your body all the time, every day. And, you know, the brain is not just ruling like a dictator. It definitely does control a lot of physiologic functions, but it's listening to and constantly integrating feedback from your organs. And so there's this bi-directional chemical conversation happening. And with age, we think that changes in that chemical conversation might lead to some of the phenotypes that we see with respect to systemic aging. So we got into reproductive function many years ago, studying one of these long-range signaling molecules, one of these chemical words in the conversation. And so research in my lab is really focused around trying to understand how the conversation between brain and ovaries changes with age, and whether we might discover some new words in the conversation that could potentially help to maintain that endocrine functioning of the ovaries after menopause. And to be clear, while I think we can separate them experimentally and also physically, the things we're studying are intricately linked to fertility as well, right? So preserving ovarian function hopefully will also have beneficial effects on the fertility side as well, because I think, you know, all of these things come down to issues of equality, right? The fact that human females go through this reproductive decline in midlife, it really impacts every aspect of their well-being, and men simply don't have that. So that's research in my lab. I would say at the Buck Institute, we've tried to tackle this from a couple of different angles. And one is that we've put together these reproductive longevity and equality initiatives. I call them RLE initiatives. And one is internal. So we built a center, the world's first center that is solely focused on reproductive aging through the lens of aging in the rest of the body. And the other one is a global consortium. And so the global consortium is really meant to build the ecosystem around this space. There's been a historic lack of funding, a lack of focus in this area. And so we don't have the data, right? Those questions that you were asking me at the beginning of our chat, we should know the answers. It's not unknowable. It's just that we literally haven't done the research to figure it out. So when we started the center, it became clear pretty quickly that if we were going to have an impact, we needed to do something much, much bigger. And so the consortium is intended to basically provide resources to accelerate taking the science and the discoveries that are made in a lab and translating them into women's hands faster. So we give away grants to scientists all over the world to study this. We're filling a hole that has been left by governmental funding agencies, NIH, and others that really have not historically funded research in this space. And then we build resources both for the grantees, for our center members, but also for the field to really try to attract as many creative, intelligent scientists and also clinicians from every area of biology to work on this problem. So that's what we're trying to do.
And I know you're also doing some wonderful work on disseminating some of this information and some of the science to the public. You have the Over Our series and I believe another series at the Buck Institute, and those are fantastic.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. We started those during the pandemic. You know, the consortium's only 3 years old, and part of the mandate really is to include everyone in the conversation. So that means not just the scientists and the clinicians, but also people like you, people like your viewers who might be our ambassadors who can spread the word about what we're doing. I think that you know, knowledge is really important, and so many women don't have that basic knowledge about their own bodies. Beyond that, the OVA Hour is really just me talking to people that I meet as I'm building out this ecosystem, because I spend a lot of time talking to funders and ambassadors and early stage founders and people in pharma and government as we're trying to lobby some of these funding bodies to devote more resources towards this problem. So I meet a lot of interesting people, and you know, that's what OVA Hour is about. The other series was a limited series to focus on highlighting our first grantees. So we've given away two rounds of grants, 7.4 million and 7.1 million to almost 50 scientists all over the world. And that first series was to highlight the research around our first grantees, to give them a platform in the pandemic when there wasn't a lot of in-person stuff going on.
That's fantastic. And I think one of the research that particularly caught my eye was the fact that one of the scientists developing this biological clock to actually test what the biological age of women's ovaries look like. So going back to my initial question on what is even the progression of aging, why are we not able to measure this?
Yeah, that's pretty frustrating. As a woman, I feel like I have a pretty good grasp on the knowledge around this space, and I don't have any idea where I am in my trajectory. I can guess, I can make educated guesses, but there really isn't a good way to tell an individual where she is in that reproductive span trajectory. And it's really very, very different at the level of the individual. It's incredibly stochastic and hyper variable and complicated. So right now we don't have any good diagnostic tools. I think there's a lot of work being done to develop them. We funded some grants in the space, but we're not there yet. And one of the blessings and the curses of this field getting a lot of attention, I hope through some of our efforts over the last few years, is that there's a lot of for-profit companies cropping up that are offering things that I think are overhyped and oversold. You know, we don't have a good way to measure someone's reproductive span timeline yet. I hope that in the next few years we will have that, but it's not going to be something simple like pee on a stick. It's going to be something that's probably more complicated than that. And that will hopefully take into account all of these signals that we know about, and maybe some that we have yet to discover to help us understand where we are.
Going back to your research on the brain and the chemical connection, the Wi-Fi, as you called it, between the hypothalamus and the ovaries, do you think we can tweak some of this connection, or is your research more fundamental, focused on what is even happening and maybe we can tweak other parts of this?
I mean, I hope that the goal of our work is to really understand what those causal driving factors are. And I say factors plural because I just assume it's not one thing, but I don't actually know. And I don't know, you know, I don't know whether it's something that originates in the ovaries that's signaling to the brain, or vice versa, or maybe it's one of each, or maybe it's several of each in each direction. We just don't know. So a lot of our work is discovery based, but the goal at the end of the day is to understand what those things are so that we can work to replace them if necessary, turn them down if necessary, right? We also don't know what direction they might change in. It could be that something goes up and that's bad. I think a lot of the, you know, there's a lot of sort of simplistic thinking, or at least people tend to try to boil things down to very simplistic conclusions. And at the end of the day, female physiology, female cycling, the hormonal cues that are flying back and forth, these are really complicated. And so it's really going to be, I think, a question of understanding the timing, the location, and the amounts, right? The relative amounts. It's going to be about tuning all of those things to try to, as much as possible, keep that kind of signaling intact.
Okay, wonderful. I know one of the things you mentioned in tweaking this is also just how much of a game changer it would be if women at the age of 40 had even 1% more eggs than they currently have with the decline that they see. Can you talk about how this relates to number of eggs versus the quality of eggs as well?
Yeah, they're both declining with age. So lots of people are hyper-focused on the numbers. And of course, the numbers are important. But equally important is the quality. And we don't fully understand. I think we can say that we've characterized a lot of the downstream consequences of the decline in quality. But what's driving that, like what is causing that to happen, we don't know. And so what we do know is that egg quality is very intricately linked to sort of health parameters in the rest of the body. So what I mean by that is, we can't just focus on like ovaries in isolation or eggs in isolation. We have to think about not just the egg itself or the follicle, but then the microenvironment around it, which is changing with age. And the macro environment around it, which is changing with age, like thinking about a woman's body as a whole system and trying to optimize every part of it. Now, I don't mean biohacking. I just mean that, you know, we already know that if there's dysfunction, for example, in your metabolic system, that can influence, you know, your reproductive function. And so I think it's really important that we think about women's health as a holistic thing and not just hyper-focus on one organ system or one thing that's going wrong in isolation. And I should just say very quickly, I am not a medical doctor. I don't give medical advice. And I'm a PhD scientist, so I can speak to the science around it, but I can't give you advice about medicine.
Right. Yeah. Because as you say, I mean, biology is just so interconnected. It's really hard to study it in isolation.
And yet we do. We call them reproductive organs, right? Which I think by itself is a real, it does a disservice to us, but also to the way that people think about them, right? By calling them reproductive organs, we're sort of pigeonholing them and ignoring the fact that they do a lot more than just facilitate, you know, birthing live offspring.
I'm curious about the role of genetics in ovarian health. I know one of the things you mentioned is how if the older you have menopause, the longer you live. But what was fascinating about this is that the brothers of people who have menopause later also tend to live longer, I believe.
Yeah.
Is there a genetic component here?
Well, there must be. The thing, so it's a fascinating, those are like fascinating studies. They're not mine. And it's a correlation. So that's important to point out. Like nothing there is implying causation, but we don't know. We just don't know. There's a correlation between age at natural menopause. That's important to say because, you know, menopause can happen through other non-natural means earlier, but age at natural menopause is correlated with overall lifespan. And again, that's a correlation and it's on average. It doesn't mean that if you went through menopause early that you're going to die young. It's just, you know, these are just statistics. But it is really interesting that that extends to male brothers. And so that does imply that there's some genetic component there that's probably important. Clearly, it's not the only thing, but it does mean that, you know, that's one hint that we can learn a lot about aging in the rest of the body by studying ovaries.
Okay. So is there something that young women should know about their family history? Should I be asking my mother certain questions regarding just to know, get a better picture of ovarian health?
I mean, sure. I think it's really important to know, to find, to get as much knowledge as you can from your mom and your parents, because, you know, genetics certainly do play a role in every aspect of your health. But it's not the only thing. I would say there's pretty reasonable data that age at natural menopause can be genetic, meaning that if you're, you know, whatever age your mom went through menopause, that is a, you know, maybe a pretty good indication of when you might go through menopause. Although again, there's a lot of other things that can influence that. But yeah, I think understanding your family history of cancer is really important for thinking about what's going to happen as you get older. Yeah, absolutely.
Taking a step back, why do we even undergo menopause? Is there an evolutionary benefit to this?
Maybe. I'm sorry that every question you ask me, I'm going to say, we don't know. Possibly.
No, I totally get it.
Well, you probably know this, but human females are very strange in the animal kingdom. There's almost no other species of animal that goes through menopause. And so, you know, that tells me two things. It tells me that it's probably not a biological imperative, right? If not every animal is doing it, that means there's other strategies that we could adopt. But why it happens, why it evolved, did it evolve, or is it just some vestige of some other program? That's a fascinating question. And I think if we could understand the answer to that, then we would be a lot further along in understanding what those driving causal factors are behind ovarian aging. So that's an area of active research. We just gave away a grant in our most recent round to someone who is going to study just that question. One of my OVA hours was with her, Dina Amira. She's part of our center, and she is an evolutionary geneticist who's been studying the evolution of female biology for her whole career. And it's fascinating to hear her talk about it. You know, she can tell you all the different theories that might explain it. But, you know, we have yet to really find evidence to support or not support all of those theories.
If you remember some of them, I'm curious, what are some of her theories?
Oh gosh, I won't be able to explain this as eloquently as she could. This is definitely not my area of expertise. But a lot of people will point to the grandmother hypothesis, this idea that maybe menopause evolved on purpose so that women who are past their reproductive age, right? Just generally speaking, when we're talking about evolutionary biology, evolution doesn't care about you once you've passed on your genes, right? So whatever's happening after you can no longer reproduce, evolutionary pressure is not very high, right? Evolution's not really interested or functioning after that. So one idea is that older women, you know, thinking back to like hunter-gatherer days, that older women have really important and valuable knowledge about where the food is, how to get the food, how to take care of the babies, and maybe they could provide, you know, some childcare while mom is out getting food. You know, that there's some both wisdom and also just extra pairs of hands that are good at taking care of babies. But that's not, you know, that's probably not the answer. But it makes intuitive sense, right, when you think about it.
So the intuitive sense here is that so that the grandmothers can't reproduce, they'd be just taking care of the family and the grandkids at that point.
Yeah.
Okay. But I guess the intuitive sense doesn't align with why have so many negative consequences to that.
Well, that's the thing, right? It's not that it might just be that it's not, I don't think that we can say that the things that happen are intentional, right? The things that happen are just a byproduct of your ovaries stop working. So that all these things that happen are byproducts. They're not necessarily there for a purpose. And that kind of speaks to the idea that evolution, once you've stopped being able to reproduce and pass on your genes, there's no evolutionary pressure. Evolution doesn't care what happens to you. So there's, you know, there's in the aging field, there's a lot of discussion around this idea that there are programs and developmental trajectories that are super important early in life. Where there's a lot of regulation, there's a lot of reason for them. They're very specific and they do certain things. But then those same programs, if they continue to run later in life, that they can be detrimental, right? But evolution doesn't care about you once you're past. And so there's no evolutionary pressure to get rid of those detrimental effects later in life. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it makes total sense. That's fair. Yeah, I think that's a pretty reasonable theory.
Well, again, I don't think it explains everything, but it certainly makes intuitive sense.
For sure. Okay, hormone replacement therapy. This is something that's talked about a lot. There was a lot of controversy surrounding it a few years ago regarding a paper, and I think that's been debunked. So would love for you to speak to some of this.
Yeah, oh gosh. Well, let's see. I will start by saying I'm not a medical doctor. So again, not giving medical advice. HRT or hormone replacement therapy is the idea that at least for some of those chemical words in the conversation, we do understand what they are, right? So some of the Wi-Fi signals that I was talking about, some of them are steroid hormones. So things like estrogen, progesterone, testosterone. And certainly estrogen is a major component of this symphony and this conversation. And so hormone replacement therapy is simply the idea that, well, why don't we try to add back some of those hormones that go away when ovaries stop working? And so for decades, it was a standard of care to help women who are menopausal to deal with some of those negative health risks. And in 2002, there was a research paper that was published based on data from the WHI, the Women's Health Initiative study. And it was published and it was flawed. And more than that, the press picked up a message that wasn't even true. That wasn't even like in the data, but they picked up and amplified this message that HRT was not beneficial, that it was in fact detrimental, that it had all these negative consequences. And since then, so that was a very long time ago, since then there have been dozens, if not hundreds, of studies published on hundreds of thousands of women showing that actually the study was flawed, conclusions were wrong, and in fact, the conclusions that were amplified, they weren't even statistically significant. So it was just a lot of misinformation. Unfortunately, that misinformation has really persisted to today. So a lot of women have this idea that HRT is bad, that it's going to give them breast cancer, that, you know, it's that there's no benefit to it. But in fact, HRT can be very beneficial. And, you know, I won't go into details on all of the things that were wrong with the study. There's been a lot of reviews and papers published sort of taking it apart. They used a patient population that was really pretty far past menopause. So one thing it's important to know if you're considering HRT, and that should be a conversation between you and your doctor, is that it needs to be started within a pretty narrow window when menopause happens. So there's pretty good data to show that if you start taking it 10 years after menopause or beyond, that it can have a detrimental effect. So you know there's a sweet spot for timing in terms of starting it. And so they were testing it in people who were way past that sweet spot. But beyond that, the dosing, the components, the way they did it, the whole study was flawed. So coming back to the idea that it's actually really beneficial, I think because it was maligned for so long and because doctors stopped prescribing it and had this idea that it was harmful, it hasn't really evolved. So the way that we administer HRT is kind of like a sledgehammer. There's not a lot of options in terms of dosing. It's a little bit, it's a place where I think we have a lot of opportunity to personalize and individualize it and to make improvements in how we deliver it. So some women will start HRT, experience some side effects because, you know, the dose is too high or the components aren't properly, you know, balanced with respect to each other for the individual. And then they'll stop. But what's important to understand is that every woman is different. You know, like I said before, female physiology is incredibly complex. And so it's really important to try to find the right dosing that is right for your physiology. And so definitely a really important conversation to have with your physician. And I want to be clear, it's not for every woman. So there are, you know, for some women, it might not be appropriate due to their health history. And so for that, those conversations, it's really important to bring in your doctor. But in general, HRT is beneficial for most women. And while you need to start it as close to menopause as possible, you know, there's huge benefit in terms of cardiovascular disease risk, in terms of osteoporosis, right? 80% of the people on the planet who have osteoporosis are women. And that's because estrogen and progesterone signaling to your bone is really important for maintaining bone density. So there's a lot of good reasons to take it. And I think I'm very hopeful that we have a lot of entrepreneurs and a lot of companies that are interested in this. And there's a huge opportunity to make HRT better than it is right now.
That's amazing. Yes, I certainly hope it gets much better. Why do you think there's such a narrow window in when it's beneficial to take it?
Yeah, I mean, I can tell you in a hand-wavy sort of way. So estrogen, progesterone, all of these hormones that are going back and forth between your different tissues, they're small molecules, right? So they're chemicals, and they don't do anything unless they bind to an appropriate receptor, right? So, you know, estrogen doesn't signal to every tissue. It only signals to the tissues that express, that have the right binding site, right? So you can kind of think of it like some people call it like a catcher's mitt, but the catcher's mitt is shaped exactly for only estrogen. So no other ball could fit there. So it's like a very specific catcher's mitt that some cells have on their surface and others don't. And so what happens is if there's no estrogen binding to those receptors, those catcher's mitts, eventually the receptors get taken off the cell surface, right? So that if in the absence of any signaling, the cell will turn off the receptors, right? It's listening and not getting anything, you know, not hearing anything. So eventually they'll take the receptors off the cell surface. And unfortunately, if you add back estrogen later, they're not going to come back. So I think that's, you know, that's why there's a sweet spot of timing.
Very interesting. Okay, that explains it. I'm also curious to learn more about the perimenopause stage.
Yeah.
It's the decade or so before menopause. Is there something we can study from that stage to understand menopause better?
Yeah, I think, I mean, we, like I said, we don't know when those causal factors or cues are happening, and could be during perimenopause, could be earlier, could be some combination of something that happens then and also earlier. So perimenopause is fascinating because that's the period of time where, excuse me, the sort of the more precipitous part of the decline happens. And it's, you know, the decline is an average. And so what's really happening at the level of the individual is lots of things are going up and down, and sort of going kind of crazy in both directions. And so understanding, you know, how things change, like what sort of, you know, a lot of people think about this historically as like noise that would just be difficult to measure. But actually, I think, you know, in the modern world, we're perfectly capable of measuring these things. The question is, what do they mean? And the problem, I think, that has cropped up with what you were talking about earlier, diagnostics telling us where we are, is that right now, we don't know. If you were to measure, you know, 10 different hormones and things that you can measure right now, estrogen, progesterone, testosterone, FSH, LH, AMH, inhibin A, inhibin B, you could measure all of these at a time resolution, you know, across a cycle, across several cycles. I think we could probably do that now, but we don't know what that data means. And so what we need, before we have, you know, pee on a stick to measure all these things, what we need is large-scale clinical studies that that do collect data like that, and then actually study what those signals mean. Because in the absence of that kind of information, like gathering a bunch of clinical data points about yourself, I mean, I've done this myself, it doesn't really get you anywhere if we don't know what it means. So yeah, I think there's a lot of opportunity for studying what's happening there and for making some sense out of it. And again, this is not unknowable. It is simply that we need to do those large scale clinical studies. We need to collect that data, and then we need to apply, you know, sophisticated algorithms and data analysis to understand what's happening.
Why is the history of funding and research on women's health so poor in this field?
Well, women's health in general, I think, has been relegated to like a niche subcategory of medicine forever. I think it's probably a combination of sex bias in both in biomedical and in clinical research, and societal taboos around talking about women's bodies. 10 years ago, there wasn't much discussion of menopause in the common vernacular. We don't talk about periods and menstruation. We do now, but historically we haven't. Certainly my mother and my grandmother never talked about this with each other or with their friends. And I think the generation of women, you know, right ahead of me and my generation, certainly your generation, we're all coming up against these things and being really unpleasantly surprised by how, number one, how little information there is for me about my health, but also just how little physicians and scientists know. So, I mean, we're trying to change things, but there has been just a shockingly low lack of level of funding from biomedical research private side, you know, investment in women's health, it was hovering around 1% of all biopharma investment up until a few years ago. Now we're somewhere just shy of 4%. And that's not for reproductive aging. That is for all of women's health, like from conception through death. So I think there's just, you know, what we fund, whether on the private side or on the public side, what we fund dictates what we know. And so the lack of knowledge is just a direct reflection of how little money has gone into this space.
I'm glad you're changing that, and there is definitely more talks around it.
I'm so doing my best.
It's hopeful for the future. Going from menopause to all the way to the beginning of the cycle, as in when a girl first starts menstruating, I believe the average age at which that's starting has been going down. And I'm not sure of the exact numbers, but I think I read this somewhere. Is that also detrimental to longevity? And why do you think that's happening? And maybe is that worth studying as well for this field?
100%, totally worth studying. I agree. Yes, the average age for menarche is going down. I don't think we know why that is. I think that there are lots of theories around it. And again, not my area of expertise. There is not a direct connection that I'm aware of in the data between age at menarche, so the age at which you start cycling, and age at natural menopause. But understanding why that number is changing, why girls are developing faster, going through puberty earlier, that's all, I think, really interesting and potentially germane to the conversation around ovarian aging, because there's lots of different ways that I could dream up strategies to preserve ovarian function. And one very obvious one is to find a way to preserve the number of eggs you have. And there's lots of different ways you could imagine doing that. And we don't know what will work, and we don't know what's feasible. And so any studies along, you know, female reproductive trajectory, I think, are really worth doing. And the very long-winded answer, sorry, is that we don't really know the answer to those questions. And so, again, this is a place where we just need to collect the data and do the analysis.
Because I presume that the earlier you start, the faster your decline would be in eggs
or
egg quality.
So,
is that not right?
No, that doesn't really resonate. The reason is, like, if you have, so how many times do you have a sense for how many times you might ovulate on average in your life? Like, how many cycles are you going to go through? Have you ever thought about that? If you live
about
to be
once a month,
if you live
right?
to be so once about every 20, a 28 day cycle is a total myth. Nobody has a 28 day cycle. It's different at the level of the individual, and it varies a lot. But if you know, if you are lucky enough to live to midlife, how many cycles are you going to go through? Do you have a sense?
I would guess around 45.
No, somewhere
40, maybe
somewhere between 300 and 400, probably, because you're doing approximately 12 a year.
Oh, right, 12 a year. I was just counting per year. Yeah. Yes, so 12 times that. Sorry, yeah.
Yeah, a few hundred.
Yeah, around 300 or 400. Yeah.
A few hundred. So that's a few hundred eggs that you're going to ovulate. You started with 6 or 7 million. And when you started cycling, you probably had somewhere between 300,000 and 400,000. And of that, you're going to ovulate 300 or 400. And so it probably doesn't matter if you're off by 12 in either direction, right?
Yeah.
So when you start thinking about it that way, it doesn't make a lot of sense. Yeah. Sorry. At least not to me.
Yeah. Yeah, I see what you mean. PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome, I'm not sure if you're too deep into this research, but it seems like that's also been on the rise, and especially in Asia and India. I'm Indian, and I hear about this all the time, it seems like, these days. What's going on there?
Well, I mean, Again, I'm not a medical doctor, and it is fascinating. I don't know if it's a question of women are more aware and more likely to talk to their doctors when they have these symptoms, right? I think that there has been historically a lot of gaslighting between physicians and patients where women bring concerns to their doctors and they're not really taken seriously. That's probably one component of it. But there does seem to be a difference in the prevalence of something like PCOS based on your self-reported genetic or racial background. And so, yeah, it's more prevalent in Asia, and we don't know why. It's a really interesting question because we know for something like PCOS that if you have underlying dysfunction in your metabolic system, you're more likely to have PCOS and vice versa. So there's some link there between physiology overall and what's happening in your ovaries. But we don't really understand what causes PCOS. What we do know is that, and so just for everyone on the podcast, polycystic ovarian syndrome. And so the name of it's a syndrome, which in doctor speak means we don't know what it is. right? Called a syndrome, that means like we've got no idea. And polycystic, literally, they're just calling it by what they see, which is that the ovary, which in a human is about the size of your ovaries are about the size of a grape, maybe a little bigger, a big grape. Your ovaries develop these cysts, these fluid-filled cysts that can be much bigger, and there can be many of them, than your ovary itself. So when you see an ovary that's polycystic, it's really dramatic. And of course, that can cause all kinds of problems, lots of pain and other things. But what's interesting about PCOS is that everything can work, right? So everything's there and can work. It's like there's no part of the system that's broken in a way that it doesn't work. It's like it's stuck in third gear or something. Like if you get the right cues and if you get all the right stuff and everything gets is happening correctly, you do get ovulation and you don't get these cysts. But and so it's a really fascinating, it's fascinating from a scientific perspective. I think it's really interesting, and we spend a little bit of time thinking about what causes it. But yeah, we don't know
Definitely.
why. Certainly there's no question that your environment, both in terms of like your macro environment that you live in and what you expose yourself to, but also your genetic makeup definitely has a strong influence on a lot of these diseases or syndromes that occur in the reproductive system.
So even part of PCOS and outside of it, one of the things that's considered not normal is having irregular cycles or skipping your period. I think athletes many times skip their period, right? And I actually believe I heard, don't quote me on this, but I heard Rhonda Patrick talk about how, sometimes skipping your period is it boosts your longevity. I'm guessing because you're probably not losing eggs that month, but. So it's, I guess going back to maybe just the athletes part, is that not healthy?
That's a loaded question. I don't know if I would call something healthy or not healthy. I would say that sometimes, yes, elite athletes do undergo something called what's it called? Hypothalamic amenorrhea, which basically just means like your hypothalamus isn't making this one particular signal that signals to your pituitary, which then sends another signal to your ovaries to do the cycle. And I think I would not call that healthy. That's my personal opinion. I think certainly skipping periods. There is no evidence that that has a beneficial effect on your longevity. I would think to the contrary, actually. So the signal that isn't released properly in the hypothalamus is called GnRH. It's one of these Wi-Fi signals. And GnRH signals to your pituitary to release the the other hormones that are important for signaling to ovary to set up the cycle so that you can release estrogen from your ovaries and the cycle continues. And I think, well, there's good evidence that GnRH goes down with age, just in general. And Dongshen Kai's lab has actually shown that if you restore GnRH function in older animals, it has a real beneficial effect on health span measurements. So in fact, from that perspective, I think, you know, missing cycles and reducing your GnRH levels. Again, this is not my area of expertise, so I don't think we know what causes hypothalamic amenorrhea in elite athletes. I think that certainly like a lack of fat. So fat also is an endocrine organ, and it secretes hormones that are really important for health. And again, having too much of it is not a good thing. Having too little of it is also not a good thing. So I think that's part of it, but I think there are probably other things going on there as well. So no, I definitely wouldn't characterize it as healthy. And there's no evidence that if you skip a cycle, again, this comes back to those numbers we were just talking about, that that's somehow going to save your ovarian reserve, or that it's going to, you know, have a beneficial effect on your reproductive longevity.
I see. Perhaps that the body thinks it's just undergoing stress, which is why they might
exactly.
be skipping.
And if you think about it, right, if you don't have GnRH and you don't cycle, your ovaries aren't releasing estrogen. So it's almost like you're mimicking some aspects of menopause, right? And estrogen is important for, like we talked about before, bone health and heart health and muscle health. And so in some ways, I would think that you might experience some of those increased risks at an age when you shouldn't.
Have we studied women who perhaps haven't had such negative consequences post-menopause, perhaps the ones who've had a relatively healthier menopause than the average woman? And I don't know if there's any scientific evidence here, or maybe just anecdotal, and if there's something we can learn from such women.
Yeah, I guess I would caution you to stay away from the word healthier. You know, I don't think of menopause as being like an unhealthy state. It just, you know, your risk of a lot of different diseases goes up. And I think what you're talking about is actually the vasomotor symptoms that are associated with the menopause transition, right? That ramp up during perimenopause, and then a lot of women experience them after menopause as well. And so those vasomotor symptoms there's over 100. But the most common ones, the ones that we hear about most often, are hot flashes and trouble sleeping and brain fog. Those are the most common, but there's so many other things that happen. You know, estrogen is important for maintaining sexual health and urinary health. And so there's a lot of symptoms that are associated with the menopause transition. And I think that's what you're referring to. And so more than 70% of women experience some of those symptoms, but it's incredibly variable, like which symptoms you have, how severe they are. And so there are some women who are lucky enough not to have super dramatic symptoms going through menopause. And so, yeah, there's a lot of work being done right now to try to understand what is it. Again, this is getting at these individual differences between women, which again will give us clues about what those causal driving factors might be. But the idea is, you know, well, first of all, at the most basic level, if we can really nail down like who's more likely to get which symptoms when, right? So based on things like physiologic things you can measure, like BMI, but also based on self-reported race and ethnicity, right? There are differences between which symptoms women experience and how severe they are based on those metrics. Socioeconomic status also seems to play a role as well, but none of these things explain everything. So there's a lot of work going into understanding just who gets what when, because that will help improve the standard of care, right? If I'm a physician and I have a patient come to me with who's in the perimenopausal age range, then I might, and if the studies are solid and the data is clear, then I might think about, the top 10 symptoms that she's likely to experience based on everything I know about her as a human. And that I think could be really transformative. Beyond that, it'll give us those clues that we're looking for. So yeah, there's some really cool stuff going on. I work with a company called Evernow to advise them on their science. They do direct-to-consumer HRT telemedicine. And the reason that I agreed to advise them is because they were willing to share their data. And so they have the largest perimenopausal survey that's ever been done, 67,000 women across a lot of different self-reported race and ethnicity groups. And so we're able to see like which symptoms different groups of women are experiencing when, and it's fascinating.
Wow, that is. I love exercise, so I have to ask as one of my closing questions. Mm-hmm. Does exercise play a role in smoothing some of this transition?
Potentially. I think ovaries are just like the rest of your tissues, except they're aging at an accelerated rate. So everything that we know about that impacts aging in a positive way in the rest of your body will also have a beneficial effect on ovarian aging. And so that means that diet and exercise, like what you put into your body and how you take care of it, are the number one things that you can do right now to have a beneficial effect. And exercise is so key, especially for women to maintain their bone and their muscle health. I think it's not the answer that people want, right? But people just want you to tell them some magic bullet, some pill they can take. But I think if you were to do a controlled clinical trial with exercise up against literally any anti-aging drug or intervention right now, that exercise would win by a mile. Like there's nothing else you can do that would be as beneficial. So yeah.
Totally agree. It feels so great as well. okay, Jennifer, we've covered a lot. So I just want to leave with a few open questions. Is there anything else you want to talk about that we haven't touched upon?
Oh my gosh, no, we did a pretty good survey of the space. I would say for those of you in the audience who are interested in what we're doing, everything that we're doing is through philanthropy, right, at this stage. So I raise all of the money for the grants. And so as much as we can spread the word about what we're doing, and the more money I can raise, the more money we can give away, and the faster I hope we can get to a place where we no longer have to have these kinds of conversations, and instead we can talk about something else.
Hi again, everyone. If you enjoyed that episode, please share it with a loved one. And if you want to access the show notes and the transcripts, you will find it at livelongerworld.com. Also, if you want to follow some longevity tips, you can follow me on X, formerly Twitter, and Instagram at AsthaJS. That's it for now, and I will see you next time. Thank you for listening.